Oh, hello there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our journalist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy. How are you doing?
Hey, Margaret. I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
It's good to have you back, Margaret.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Not by telephone, but by person.
Last week, I was recovering from strep throat, and Margaret is a strep throat champ, and had to stay away because it was pretty intense. And neither Oliver nor Winter are able to be here, so we broke the glass case. It is Pop Rocket's fifth Beatle, Karen Toxin.
Hey, everybody.
Hello, Karen.
Welcome
back. What have you been doing since last you were at Pop Rocket?
Aside from crying and eating Cheetos, you know, just my usual thing.
Why on earth would you be doing that, Karen?
Well, who
it's
knows?
Not I'm as just though democracy has been embattled.
I'm just a sad lesbian. There we go.
And in the Winter Mitchell spot tonight is a comedian and my co-worker, co-writer on The Mindy Project, Mr. Chris Schleicher.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Chris, what should people know about you?
I mean, basically, my like super villain backstory is that I was a competitive figure skater from age 5 to 21 with my little sister as my pair partner. So like all of like the strangenesses of me like come out of that.
So you understand that why when I imagine Chris's mom, all I can think of is just a Joan Crawford character. Like imagining her in color seems ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Chris, are you additionally a very gifted sketch performer who regularly performs here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, you can see me sometimes at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
Would it be fair to say that you were the first openly gay president of the Harvard Lampoon?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm waiting for another person to claim they were out at the time, but the history books, I think, will show.
Also, considering Pop Rocket's preference for not straight white guys on our panel, are there any other Harvard Lampoon presidents who would even remotely qualify?
Oh, the current one.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. I shattered a glass ceiling for him.
Wow.
I didn't receive a single gift.
Well, delightful. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about Netflix's most expensive original series ever, The Crown. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have got our attention this week. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about the Insight Timer app. It's a free meditation app, and it has millions of people on it meditating at all times around the world. And I've always been a meditator, but about a month before the election, I started getting really stressed out and feeling like I really needed to channel some Zen. Know what I'm saying? So I got the Insight Timer app, and it's been really amazing, really remarkable. You can find any kind of meditation you want on there. There's like 5-minute little quick stress breaks. There's like hour long deep dives. There's talks and lectures from like monks and yogis and people who have lots of wise things to say when our world goes up in flames. And I highly recommend it. I know there's a lot of meditation apps out there like Headspace that costs a lot of money, but this one's free and it's so It goes so deep. There's thousands of meditations on there.
For people whining about there aren't enough hours in the day, give us your elevator pitch for taking 2 minutes to an hour or whatever to just be.
It's very – I mean, there are all these studies now that if you meditate for something like 5 or 10 minutes a day, that you really are changing the wiring in your brain. Like there are neuroscientists that are working on these kind of ideas at like Yale and Stanford, like big time places. And I think we're only going to learn more and more about that as meditation hopefully gets embedded in the culture, because it's only gotten more popular for good reason. I've actually done a lot of reporting on mindfulness and meditation in the past. Talked with David Lynch about it one time, which was amazing. I wish that I still had him saying my name, Margaret, in that like super Midwest way. But at any rate, like he's working on getting it into schools. UCLA has an organization that gets it into schools. So I think it's going to be like all of our children will be meditating.
Did I already share with you guys the story of how When I was a child, when my dad would go to the bathroom for number two, he would say he was meditating. And so I always associated the word meditation with taking, you know, El Dumpola.
Yeah. And, it is where some of us do our deep thinking.
But anyway, I realized I just shattered that beautiful thought around like collective meditation with a dumb poop joke, but whatever.
Hey, any deep moment counts.
Of the smartphone ruined the bathroom as a meditation space. You know, it was a time when you weren't doing anything and like left alone with your thoughts, and now it's like Bejeweled is taking up your whole time.
I've long maintained that the bubble bath occupies the place in the Western tradition that you know, meditation does in like Asian cultures, that it is just time with yourself.
Maybe we all have to demand of ourselves that we go into airport mode when we go into
Margaret's real good about stuff like that. She like took 3 days off from her phone. It's always very impressive.
Wow.
A whole whopping 3 days.
I don't know how to do it. Karen, what are you all about this week?
Well, so in my crying Cheeto jag, it was very difficult for me to consume popular culture because, you know, the TV was a site of trauma. So I'm going to – I know I'm violating a Pop Rocket rule by naming two things. So one of the things that I do want to kind of just shout out briefly without elaborating too much about is that I made myself go out and see queer performance in person. And
in Los Angeles? In, is that legal?
Oh, I know. I can't believe – well, only in Los Angeles. Only in the Calexit state of California. Mm-hmm. But in any case – Sorority is this program of like – it's kind of a mix of storytelling, stand-up, poetry, like performance, and curated by – run by this wonderful playwright, Gina Young, based here in L.A. And I just – they had a showcase at the Hamburg Museum this weekend. And frankly, like after the Oakland fires, after like so many forms of having to grapple all over again with queer death and, like, you know, the possibility of, like, violence against queers and queer extinction. It felt really amazing being in a lesbian space or, like, a queer feminist space that, you know, where you could talk – you could tell dirty jokes about Mishfest and do things like that. And so that was very moving. But the, when I was finally able to reconvene with the television, of course, I had to go to that deep – like kind of banquet table of comfort food that is Gilmore Girls, A Year in a Life. And,
all right,
you know,
let's talk about this. Yeah. First of all, just let me say, what are your thoughts on the fact that like Netflix and Amazon, these places where we consume so much media now, more Netflix, is insulated from news and insulated from sort of like immediacies like politics? Did you feel safer going to Netflix than you did like watching something on regular TV?
Well, I felt like I could get like a really kind of defined set of narrative parameters. And I knew like I'd been waiting with anticipation for Gilmore Girls, the reboot anyway, right? Like I was just like, I can't wait till Thanksgiving weekend because this is going to happen, right? And I want to hear the final four words, which ended up being really a final three words or contraction making it four. I don't know. In any case, I you know, I was like totally ready because, you know, I'm a Gilmore gal.
So, I mean, we were presented with a Rory who was a whole lot less stellar and polished than she was like when she was 16 years old or when she was 22 years old. Was that disappointing to you or beautiful?
No, I thought that that was, you know, like indicative of her generational transformation. I mean, you know, like she is millennial Rory, right? And so she, like anybody else from that generation, is going to suffer from various forms of precarity and having their specialness, like the specialness of their bubble burst.
Yeah.
And so I thought that that was just a nice touch of realism.
Chris is right here.
I'm inside my bubble and I can't hear outside of it. It's yet to burst.
Well, but also, you know, but the fact that, you know, I think that that was where, like, Gilmore Girls succeeded because it had a kind of, it was, all of its flights of fancy were leavened by a particular kind of realism that was, like, you know, speaking to its moment and its era. And I think that it managed to do so, even though presumably this is sort of how Amy Sherman-Palladino imagined it would have ended, like, you know, almost a decade ago or like 7 or 8 years ago, right?
Yeah.
So, so part of me was always transposing what was happening in the action to like, wow, she wanted this to happen 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, because a lot of the ideas here were supposed to be her ideas for the seventh season.
Mm-hmm.
There was something really beautiful about getting Rory at exactly the age we met Lorelai.
Yes.
Yeah, like realizing it was – this was 16 plus 16 after this story of a 16-year-old – like single mother with a 16-year-old child. Did you feel like, these many years later, like, are they still able to write the magical chunky dialogue that they did before, or did you feel like people were tripping on it? Do you feel transported to the Stars Hollow you love?
I actually felt, in fact, that the Stars Hollow was hollow a little bit. Wow. I did feel a little bit like it was a kind of interesting sort of shadow play for those of us who just really it was kind of like, you know, a tribute performance in many respects. And it was not narratively tight. It was a pretty baggy series,
I mean,
right?
So many digressions. Yeah. So many cul-de-sacs. Fucking Paul.
Yeah. Or too much Kirk. I mean, whatever. Yeah. Like, I'm like, okay, really?
Who are you happiest to see?
Well, you know, obviously Emily Gilmore. I'm always happy to see her.
Yeah.
And, you know, and particularly in a moment of transformation and grieving and in jeans and like
that she had growth.
A cap sleeve t-shirt.
I feel like she had the most of an arc that we got from anyone.
Yeah. No, so I was really thrilled to see all of it. But at the same time, it very much felt like, yes, I know this is the WB lot, and yes, I want to be transported back there. And it did feel appropriate to the forms of melancholy that I was experiencing, like post-election, post, you know, lost, post this sense of like, you know, after the end of the world, this is what Stars Hollow looks like.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I found that when a show that I liked ended, I don't long for it to be brought back in a new form. But if it were to exist, I would obviously go watch it. But
yeah.
I feel like it's not of my generation because we have this whole nostalgia BuzzFeed, like, Fuller House, yeah, that's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
I'm like, just leave it alone. Like, I'd love the two seasons of Enlightened, and if, like, a third came, I'd be scared they would ruin it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Fantastic Beasts was fine. Chris, what are you all about this week?
Okay, so... Unlike Karen, like going for comfort in this post-November 8th world, I am about Pablo Larraín's Jackie, the biopic. Sort of a moment in Jackie Onassis's life when, spoiler alert, JFK gets shot. and she is sort of tasked with sort of planning this funeral that is going to cement his legacy in the American story. As directed by Pablo Larraín, this Chilean director who made the film Know, about these sort of advertising people who come up with this plan to unseat the dictatorship through this very positive ad.
Know is very good.
Know is fantastic, and Gael Garcia Bernal is delicious in it.
Mm. My trepidations about Jackie were Natalie Portman doing that voice the whole time.
Oh, how could you hate? We need more horses, more soldiers, more crying.
So it's wonderful. She does a great job.
It's like career best. I'm ready to vote for her for any award. But also, like, I don't think biopics are usually good. They're, like, boring, and, like, we watch someone be born and go through their whole life.
Yeah.
I saw it with a Q&A with Natalie after, and she was like, Pablo had talked to her and been like, act in any scene like it could be put anywhere into film. Like, and it is sort of like slice and dice, like flashback forward, like in this very strange, unsettling way. And there's this very moody Micah Levi score and mixed in with the Camelot soundtrack. And Jackie just, she's being like kicked out of the White House.
Yeah.
And like you see our close personal friend and coworker Beth Grant playing Lady Bird Johnson, like already there with like new drapes planning to like
oh
ruin
God.
Your old legacy. And in a space where like, the Obamas are about to be, like, forced out, and we have, like, a month left of them watching, like, Jackie, like, wear her ball gowns and drink wine as she walks through the White House listening to the Camelot soundtrack was so, like, thrilling and scary.
Chris, my two questions for you are based on two characteristics that we share deeply.
Mm-hmm.
One, homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Second, deep Oscar trivia.
Yes.
Two are not unrelated.
Yeah.
First question is, I have always been somebody who likes Iron ladies. I like people who crush things before them. And Jackie is very much of sort of like a broken, delicate creature sort of school. Do you think that those things are unrelated? Do you think it is a lack of maturity on my part that I can't respect those creatures? I would also like you guys to chime in as women.
Well, we do get – Jackie puts up like a very like glamorous, beautiful front for the cameras. But she's being fought with a lot of people. She wants to have this giant procession with horses and stuff down the street after someone's just been shot in a parade.
Yeah.
And they're like, no. Like, General de Gaulle won't do it. And she's like, if General de Gaulle wants to ride in a tank down the street, he can, but I'll be walking beside Jack's casket. And it's like this, like, this gentle little lady is, like, serving it to you, and, like, she is going to shame you if you try to.
Yeah.
I think she's a secret crusher.
Uh-huh.
I think she has it in her where she's a little bit of the Steel Magnolia type.
I mean, fucking going and marrying Aristotle or Narcissus because that's what will protect my children. I'll take whatever he does to me as long as we get Scorpios.
Yeah, lady knows how to survive.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say it's like the Jackie Onassis aspect of it later that affirms that she's a crusher.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Second question was Natalie Portman, 2 in 5 years. Like, this is fucking best actresses. Like, 2 is the most anybody's got of just best actresses. Can she pull it off? Is it long-term damaging to her career?
I mean, we got Kate Hepburn.
But I mean, like, one of those was in 1930-something.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was also worried about Natalie not being able to win.
Also, I'm sorry. That was stupid of me to say 2 was the most that anybody had of them. It more comes down to me not considering Katharine Hepburn to be a human being,
but a deity.
Yeah.
I mean, we do tend to discount, like, someone who's already won. Like, they don't need it. We need to give it to someone who's overdue in the wrong year.
Yeah.
But Hilary Swank wins in 99 and 04.
Yeah.
Sally Field wins in 79 and 84. But it's more common than you think.
I know, but I think it's been relatively bad for their careers. What was Sally Field doing after Soap Dish? Though I would love to see Natalie Portman in her Soap Dish.
I mean,
an age thing? Sorry to jump in.
That's a fair point.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what usually happens. Not them winning,
but I
them getting them close
getting
to 40.
Yeah.
And then having to do a series on TV.
But Margaret Wappler, Geraldine Page sure was showing up to do those supporting roles in, like, The Pope of Greenwich Village because she hadn't cemented herself and kind of needed to behave like a working actress still.
We'll get your close personal favorite, Glenda Jackson, twice in the 70s.
Yes.
An interesting thing about Natalie, which I think allows her to survive and not be overexposed in this Anne Hathaway sort of way, where she, like, was winning everything and people got sick of her, which was sort of unfair. But is she has these other aspects to her personality, like this Israeli French sort of things where she, like, travels. She's a husband who's, like, a great choreographer and dancer. Like, there's many facets to Natalie Portman that aren't just, like, actress, and she doesn't feel like I need to work right now. She, like, does a project when she wants to.
I once played Apples to Apples with Benjamin Millepied.
Also, interesting fact, Jackie filmed mostly in Paris.
Oh.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Jackie would have loved that. this week, I am all about something that is slight but magnificent. Who here saw the commercial Wells for Sensitive Boys on SNL this week?
Oh, I sure did.
It was magnificent. This is the second time that my All About has been a sketch that was clearly written by Julio Torres, one of the new additions to the SNL writing staff this year, who is an ephemeral gay boy, like a gay boy you just can't get your hands around because he is constantly he's inscrutable. Like, his goal in his comedy is to be magically inaccessible. And Wells for Sensitive Boys. How did you feel watching it?
It felt like I was being, like, seen, like, deeply. Like, flashback. Like, when you don't know yet, like, the things you're not supposed to ask for and you're at the video store and you ask Dad if you can rent Gigi.
Right.
Like, and, yeah, just being that boy who knows that he's different but, like, in a pre-sexual space.
The moment that, like, when his dad shouts Spencer at him 3 times, no response, his mother whispers Spencer, and he looks and says, yes, mommy. Like, the fact that he mutters things directly into his mom's side is such a close observation of children, and it is one of those things of, like, did the writers write that? Was that the director's thing? But it was so smart. And at the end, like, the most Julio moment, his signature on it is, Karen, if you haven't seen this, you fucking need to watch it.
I know.
Oh, wait, what's the basic sketch?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
The basic sketch is that, like, there are Fisher-Price playsets for, like, being a cook and for riding around on a like, little tricycle and stuff like that for all the fun things you want to do. but this is just a well for sensitive boys. So it's like a little
well
with water in it. And you can wish in it. You can tell it secrets. You can contemplate your own reflection. Also in the series, balconies for when you need to announce things, and shattered mirrors when you need to examine the complexity of
the fractured nature of your existence.
Yes.
Yeah.
At the end, like, what the announcer says is, "Yeah, you could just buy him a Barbie, But this is part of that, but it's not all of that. And it was this very Julio phrasing that tries to explain, we reduce these things to, oh, gay children are like a gay boy is like a girl. And it's like, you're missing it. You're missing it. And it was that thing of like going from comedy that is written by straight people about our existence to something that was like reflective of our existence felt magical. And to have it in such a mainstream place just felt delightful.
It also gets at a lot of that, like, there's people like, be like, there's nothing different about gay people except who we have sex with. And it's like, but then why are all these like little boys like fascinated by the Wizard of Oz? Like, there is an aspect to it that is about like an alienation, a difference, whatever produces it. It might not be the same in the future, but we have a culture that's separate from sexuality that people like
I
to be like.
I hate every fucking Slate article about the death of the gayborhood, and I hate every fucking article about how, oh, we're so accepted now, things are going to be fine. We're always going to be weird, and that's magical. Margaret.
Yes.
Okay, here's the best part of the commercial, is that a regular boy with a gun walks up and says, why are you doing that? That's weird. Mm. And then Emma Stone approaches him and says, because it's all he has. Or what is it?
Everything is for you. Let him have this one thing.
Everything is for you. Literally everything is for you. And it was just shattering.
That thing's weird. I don't get it.
That's because it's not for you. Because you have everything. Everything is for you. And this one thing is for him.
Wells for Boys by Fisher Price. Don't just give him a Barbie. I mean, it is like that, but that's just part of it.
That is how I feel though when someone's like, there's so many gay shows on TV. Ugh, like, oh wait, no, it's when people go, there are too many award shows on TV.
Yes.
And I lose my goddamn mind. I'm like, there is a sports game on every day of the whole year.
There's a sports game.
Then you have to deal with just...
like seven sports networks in addition.
Like the Oscars, the Globes, maybe like the SAG Awards are on a channel you don't even watch. Like it's such a small... And the when you get everything, like even a movement towards equality feels like discrimination to them.
Yes.
Wait, do you guys all feel like award shows are gay culture?
For a lot of us, yes. I mean, it's not for everyone, obviously, but like, yeah.
For gay men, I certainly can't speak for gay women. But the combination of pageantry, emotional vulnerability, and this weird sense of I want to win and I want to be recognized is sort of like, as I've been paying more attention to Queen lyrics, like there are some of those things of like, I want to be the hero, which is very Velvet Ragey. And I would say that like the combination of like human drama, I think the best thing about the Oscars is that we take five of the most powerful people on the planet, like celebrity-wise, and then we humiliate four of them, like over and over again. And I think that there is something, like our weird distance from regular heterosexual emotional interactions means that emotions like are fascinating to us, but we are also distanced from them. So I do feel like, you know, we are angry at people who are successful because we are alienated from being successful, but also fascinated by the glamour and the glitz. Karen.
Well, I was just thinking that it's a lot about the spirit of also like being recognized for being something else or someone else.
Yeah.
And that like, I mean, that always was for me. And I can't say that I'm, in many respects, I am very typically lesbianic. But I think that I was reared into queer culture or gay culture through like gay male culture and musicals and award shows and the whole deal. And that for me, part of that was just like a kind of an outlet for these forms of expressiveness that had no other real place or space, or also for forms of like brilliance and competency and excellence that otherwise weren't really recognized in everyday worlds, you know, and that's, you know, and that was part of the earth shattering thing about like dealing with the narrative of like this particular election, because it's just about like, oh, you know, like I've worked so hard, I've done these things, like, you know, I've been good and I've like performed the roles I've had to perform. It's like an acknowledgement of like, you know, we talk about gender performance, gender performativity. It's acknowledgement of like, I've fulfilled and performed all these roles. And at the same time, like, you know, any form of masculinity, particularly like kind of straight assertive masculinity, is just going to be acknowledged as authenticity no matter what. And that, like, that's like the real heartbreak of everything. And I think that that's part of what award shows and like shows that reflect on like this kind of grand landscape of performance do for us.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about The Crown. We're not going to have much to say about that after this.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Erin, and we host Throwing Shade, a political comedy podcast that's somehow horribly offensive and socially conscious.
If you want to know what it sounds like if the news drank straight vodka, check us out on Thursdays on Max Fun.
And we're the first Max Fun podcast to be turned into a TV show, so check that out January 17th on TV Land.
Throwing Shade. Politics. Pop culture. Wigs for days.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
Karen Tongson.
Chris Schleicher.
Recently Netflix dropped its most expensive show to date, a drama about the life of Queen Elizabeth II, beginning just before her ascension, going to 1956. My question for you guys... Does anyone care about the – like, why do we care so much about this story? Do we care so much about this story? We had the Queen. We had the audience on Broadway. We had the King's speech. Like, do we really need to hit another patch of these people's lives?
Do we need to? But like, I think that like there is something about like kind of the desire to like actually keep probing deeper and deeper into.
Well, there's something too, like the work that was done by the King's speech to explain the situation rolling into it, where you don't need to do that much footwork to talk about like the abdication of Edward VIII. Yeah.
Elizabeth is a fascinating figure because she's been around for so long, and yet we feel like we know so little about her in a way. She's like, I hate bringing things back to November 8th, like an anti-Trump figure. Like, everything he's thinking is like coming out of his mouth immediately. Like, it's a stony face, and that's part of what I like about the Claire Foy performance in
there
The Crown.
There is a dignified and efficient branch to the government.
In a year where we, like, pilloried Hillary for, like, there needs to be a difference between your public and private, how you deal with things, like, the Queen is the epitome of that.
Oh, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's also room there to explore all the political machinations that she's really in the center of. I mean, the fact that Winston Churchill is such a big figure, and I was really glad to see on the fourth episode, finally you get some pressure from, like, London itself and the climate itself, the country itself, because up until then it was pretty, like, isolationist. Like, the whole thing felt like it was just happening in this Buckingham Palace bubble.
Well, the fog really seems to have, like, shifted. A lot of people who were watching the show seem to have shifted their perspective at that episode. I was just so excited that the Great London Fog of 1952 got an episode because it's a weird thing that happened. And, like, my friend Ryan was totally like, what did they make this up? This is so stupid. And when he went to the Wikipedia entry and was like, no, that actually happened, it kind of shifted the way he was consuming the entire show.
Yeah, it makes you think that London was way closer to the Victorian, coal-drenched London of that era than the London we know now.
I'm glad in a world where straight guys get Alien versus Predator, we get the Queen versus Fog.
Well, and also we get so many queens. Like
that scene where they describe, like, which queen are you talking about? Mary, the other Queen Elizabeth, or Queen Elizabeth II?
It's so wonderful. And, like,
queens versus the queen, right?
And also, like, so frequently the story that we are told is, oh, these terrible people who only see their children for 1 hour a day, they're so broken. And, like, the scenes in the first and second episode where, like, Elizabeth is showing up and curtsying with so much affection to her mother and Queen Mary and sort of understanding this is just the life we lead. This is what we know. Magnificent.
Well, going back a little bit to Hillary in there and the fact that these characters cannot show emotion, like – Elizabeth has to be so stony-faced. Margaret has to be stony-faced, even though she's probably the worst one at it. Mm-hmm. King George, even as he's sick and dying, can't even bring himself to cry normally in a Christmas party that's going to be his last. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me is so painful in re-educating about it that, like, oh, yeah, we live in this time now where we are allowed to show a lot more emotions. And back then it was like a real liability to be seen crying as a man, to be seen crying as a woman, to be seen crying at all. It was just like, what's wrong with you? Are you going to die?
Well, I'm scared that we're only going to talk about Trump, but it does sort of make you long for the days when sort of like an official status like meant something. We took it seriously. I love – there are going to be spoilers in this. This is all – I mean it's history. These aren't spoilers.
I already spoiled that JFK got shot. I
just love those moments when Princess Margaret, who is the best, is like being witty and being awesome, and like the whole machine like comes to a halt, and it's like, you can't do that. Your job is to be boring. You can't tell a slightly ribald joke.
Also, like, in the Queen's job description is do not have an opinion.
Right.
Like, yeah.
It's God, we're gonna be talking about the election. We might as well lean into it. It reminded me of when we were watching that front line about Hillary when she goes to Arkansas and it's like, the men will go talk about politics now, you sit here.
Yeah.
I
just think the smartest thing about the show, what stunned me about it, is that they managed to so perfectly slice the right portion of history to get a 10-episode drama out of this. That, like, they sliced it in such a way that you got a full arc for Churchill, like a full arc for Margaret. And there are ways that it can feel, like, slight and boring. But did you guys find it slight? Did you find it boring? I feel like that's the jokes we're supposed to make.
At times, I feel like it takes itself just a touch too seriously. Like, I want there to be just a little more levity and a little more air breathed into it. I mean, at the same time, though, I love it. Like, there's something so incredibly stuffy about it that I'm like, you just go for
being
it.
Being so stuffy and then have Margaret and Elizabeth greet each other on the phone with, hello, you, is just makes you realize what that intimacy is.
Well, I'm always, I mean, you know, as I was a trained Victorianist in graduate school, but you know, so I'm really drawn to and in fact like find myself excited by these levels of repression and stuffiness in British culture, and particularly the British monarchy. But you know, one of the things that I always found really sort of or that I found myself struggling with the show was, you know, how it really grappled with the whole colonialism thing and like, or like the end of empire moment, but in a fairly non-critical way, insofar as even like shortly before, like on her last trip as Princess Elizabeth in Nairobi, where she's basically Taylor Swift in the Wildest Dreams video, right? You know, it's just sort of like, I was like, okay, so it's just going to be, you know, like, is it like realism? Are we just going to represent what these relations were at this time? Is there going to be any kind of meta reflection on these things, or like anything in the production of the show that indicates something different about this stuff? And that made me feel a little bit uneasy. At the same time, once again, I feel so interpolated and drawn to like these stories and these narratives and these repressed kind of like interesting British colonial histories that I didn't really care.
Well, there is a weird question with the way that we find ourselves going to this or Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Like,
what do the simple folk do to help them escape when they're blue?
Yeah. Like, we really are just sort of like embracing this whiteness and class difference, and like, is it just escaping from the complexity of a world where we have to think a little bit more, slightly more, about what's going on with people of color and the not fanciest and richest?
Circling back to the boredom for a second, I found it boring, and that was one of the things I like about it.
Uh-huh.
Post 2016, I think we need to realize that exciting is different from good.
Excellent point.
Yeah, I had written up in my thesis about boredom, and I searched into it because John Updike was super into the idea of like boredom being this like American value we were losing. And there was a sort of relevant passage, that quote from him in The New Yorker in 1961. Surely there is something untrustworthy in today's compact, delightfully witty sermons and crisp, no-nonsense political addresses. A man afraid to be boring is a man of shallow convictions. Oh, bring back the splendid, stupefying thunder of old.
Yeah.
I think like training like children even to like sit with like one toy for a long time, or things like The Crown and Mad Men where I, like, truly have to put down my phone or I won't get, like, a single moment out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Is important for, like, my mind feels like meditating almost. And these moments where, like, you drift from something and come back to it is, yeah.
Well, one of the wonderful things about watching the Crown was there was one moment, I forget what it was, but you see her, like, waking up to be, like, apprised of something. And it is this moment of realizing, like, yeah, the prime minister has an intense job that is all day long, every day, for 5 to 10 years. She has this job that, like, goes on to silent for like 4 and 5 months at a time, and she's just cutting ribbons and going to the Derby. Like, that this is a job that is not about intensity but a lifetime, is really weird to wrap your head around.
Well, and this is part of what makes, I mean, you know, Philip's impetuousness, like, you know, really kind of irritating is the kind of interruption. And I mean, you know, I feel really defensive about, like, I mean, and of course, the title of the show is The Crown, right? I mean, it is about, like, you know, the war between, like, keeping up the importance of a symbol over, like, you know, the kind of nuances of, like, petty human existence, right? So, I mean,
Speaking
I don't know.
Speaking of petty human existence, Philip, hot or not?
Not. I mean, you know, you asked a lesbian, so no.
I mean,
I know.
They, like, were very flattering to how Prince Philip looks in the casting of it. But that we are constantly finding him face down sleeping naked is, like, a very nice surprise in the crowd.
It's wonderful. And I, like, I love that they made clear he's a dickbag. He had, like, he's a racist. And he did have that much trouble with her being in charge of it. And I loved that they gave us enough of a dose of Malta that we got a feeling for what they thought their life was maybe going to be for 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, that they went into it with, like, he'll be the husband and I'll be the wife. And then one day she'll have to do this weird thing.
But it's so interesting to see Philip chafing at the things that every wife is asked to do of every king and every prime minister. Like, they are, like, the leader of the country, and you're technically, like, beneath them.
I mean, the best things are...
But he doesn't know the script. You know, women know that script from, like, day one. And he's outraged that he has to swallow that pill.
And also, he's not properly British, so he doesn't know the damn script.
Well, on the subject of swallowing pills, is there anything more glamorous than the Princess Margaret we are presented with on this show?
This might be the best thing to ever happen to Princess Margaret's legacy. Like, she's, like, verging on, like, going to be, like, a gay icon now from this show,
yes.
I feel like.
But I always thought she was so cool. I mean, I was, like, super dorky about it. Like, but, you know, like, Princess Margaret always seemed like the cool one who was just, like, smoking and, like, rocking it out. Like, had so many husbands.
Well, I want this to, I want this to go long enough that we get, like, mid-40s Princess Margaret who's, like, too tan and fucking a 25-year-old on Mystique. It's like the for her wedding, she was given,
like, original cougar.
Yes, she was given a portion of a private island, and then the rest of her life was basically like, yeah, but I got this private island.
That's weird. So was I.
But, like, there like, I mean, the smoking and the drinking and just feeling like there's no use for you. It's interesting. I feel like a woman is in a better position to be the sovereign in a modern age because we understand that that's not really entirely a job, and we kind of don't expect women to have entirely a job. But I think, like, Prince Harry is in so much a better position than Princess Margaret is, because what the fuck is she supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do think it's the privilege of the second sibling, right? Like, she doesn't have to worry about ever being the queen, so she can let loose in a certain kind of way that Elizabeth just never had that privilege to do. And when you look at William and Harry now, it's like, who has more fun?
But
Harry.
There is that moment when King George has died and everybody is rushing, and then Margaret comes out of her bedroom and she's standing there and she's got a bedroom next to his because she's the fucking princess, but nobody tells her what's going on because she does not matter.
Right.
Okay. Krish Liker, who is your favorite screen Queen Elizabeth II?
I mean, can it be anything but Helen Mirren? I mean, The Queen is one of my, like, favorite movies of this century.
Yeah.
I think it's, like, so smartly done. And we see, like, the culmination of the Elizabeth who's learned, like, how to play TV, finally being like, I have to give a speech to the people. I don't think I should. The wrestling with Diana, who's, like, the opposite of the Queen, like, fully just playing her heart on her sleeve at all times. But I, while looking into this, I thought, like, the only other queen who's really stolen my heart lately has been Fred Armisen as Queen Elizabeth on Saturday Night Live.
Fair. Margaret.
Well, you know, my answer is just, like, my favorite Queen Elizabeth II is Queen Elizabeth II. Because, I mean, one of the reasons I think we're so compelled to see people play her and for people to flesh out that particular story is because of this particular veneer that she's, you know, held through, you know, like, the better part of a century at this point. And you know, like, and I am actually, like, I want, you know, even I brought a tea towel with from the Diamond Jubilee. I'm here with me as a prop tonight.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. But it's just sort of like I'm just like that face, that particular smile. Like, I'm just like, you know, I want to know what's behind every crevice of that. And, you know, obviously we can't, you know, unearth that. You know, like we have no other window into that other than other, you know, mere mortals trying to flesh it out. So I think, you know, QE2 is QE2. And that's that for me.
Margaret.
When I first saw this question on the script, I thought you were just opening it up to all Queen Elizabeths.
Okay.
So, of course, I went for Kate Blanchett because that was just like a firestorm of a performance. And still, I can just be riveted thinking about it. But I've never been – I have to make a confession. I've never been like a real royal family movie fan. Like, this was unusual for me to watch. And if there wasn't so many people saying that it was great, I would have skipped it very easily without thinking twice about it. But so far, this, I think – I really like Claire Foy in this. Mm-hmm. I think she's really outstanding. And there's something about it being like a deep, slow dive that's more interesting to me than seeing a movie version of the Queen Elizabeth.
In praise of Helen Mirren one more time. She could complete a interesting feat where she could have an EGOT with like just Elizabeth material. She has an Oscar for playing Elizabeth II, an Emmy for playing Elizabeth I, and a Tony for playing Elizabeth II. If she can just like read like a book about Queen Elizabeth or something and win a Tony, it would be a full Elizabeth EGOT.
Look, you're right about Helen Mirren because it's getting that Queen Elizabeth that we know the most who's just like business, like who's just like woman from above the shop with the purse and with the sensible outfit and not being beautiful, like just being like sensible. And like that woman is the most appealing and the most fascinating. But I will speak up for another incarnation of her, which is Scott Thompson from The Kids in the Hall.
Does
a simply transcendent Queen Elizabeth who is a little like a little less dignified than Helen Mirren and just but more sort of like getting shit done. Like, and what a lovely perspective from a Canadian of like Queen Elizabeth like reigns over him but does not care about him. And like the sort of like prim efficiency that he brought to it. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this.
Are you in need of a shakeup? Max FunCon is our annual comedy and creativity festival, and it changes lives. Max FunCon West returns to Lake Arrowhead next June, and Max FunCon East is back in the Poconos next September. Tickets for both are on sale right now, and they will sell out. Visit MaxFunCon.com to buy your tickets today. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I am your beloved host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Chris Schleicher.
Now, every week on Pop Rocket, Chris, you're a regular listener of the show, which I appreciate. Most of my friends do not listen to it. Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask a question. Do you know what that question is?
What's your jam?
That's a good boy. Now, tell me, Chris Schleicher, what's your jam?
Okay, I considered going for, like, I like how you are a champion of upbeat pop music on this show. I considered doing, like, Little Mix shout to my ex. It's been sort of upbeat. But in my post November 8th, like, mourning and watching Jackie, they frequently show Jackie was obsessed with Camelot, like, the Broadway show, and plays the record around the White House. And they use it, like, super ostentatiously in the film. So I've been listening to the Camelot soundtrack while driving. You know, thinking about Obama and Camelot in the musical, it's a beautiful place that just sort of falls apart towards the end. And the finale song of it is incredibly melancholy and thinking about, we once had this great thing that went away, which is very much my emotions. So I've been walking around my house in my ball gowns, drinking the red wine, listening to the finale from Camelot.
Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment.
That was no.
Yes, I was just, I almost teared up there thinking about, like, that we had this great thing, this beautiful shining moment.
Do you love Camelot as a musical?
It's a little overlong, but there's some, like, super funny Julie Andrews work in there.
Oh,
like, The
I
Simple
see.
Joys of Maidenhood, like, is sort of like a precursor to Shrek, which I don't love, but, like, this, like, problematizing, like, a princess. She's, like, fascinated by men are going to kill each other for her and stuff like that.
One of my favorite Lesbian Torch songs is How to Handle the Woman, also from Camelot.
Young Julie Andrews, we just don't deserve her. This week, I began the strange cultural process of watching all of the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I don't know why I'm doing it. I've never had a real relationship with any of the Real Housewives shows.
Man. That's a commitment at this point.
I know. It's like 126
like, yes,
episodes.
7 million episodes.
But it's real good. It's totally the best of them. And I love those women. And I was going into a deep moment of just contemplating the greatness of Lisa Vanderpump. Like, I had not properly respected the fact that, like, she's always right. And she's funny so much of the time. And I was watching some of the music videos from Britain she was in the early 80s. And then who showed up? But as I had all of this sophistipop on my YouTube page, who showed up? But Swing Out Sister. The thing is, I'm sorry I'm telling two stories for this, but like the first like three or four videos I saw on VH1 and MTV after we got cable in like 1992 mean so much to me, and the great, like, it was very embarrassing, but I love VH1 so much more, and like I just fell so hard for Swing Out Sister. So let's hear Am I the Same Girl.
Why don't you stop?
So it's a remake of a 68 like soul song, but like with so much jazz laid over it. And it's a great video. You need to watch the video. It's very saturated primary colors. But also, like, the woman from it, Corinne, I believe, or whatever her name is, dressed as Frida Kahlo a good six or seven years before we as Americans fell in love with Frida Kahlo.
That's some foresight.
Margaret, do you have a jam this week? Is that possible?
I do have a jam. First, I want to just play it, and then I'm going to talk about it. So this is a band called Intro Flirt, and sadly, these guys were one of the victims of the Oakland fire, the warehouse fire. Yeah. And that fire has really been staying in my mind because whenever I look at the picture of the victims, I feel like I know all of those people. I, as a music reporter for many years, I went and covered shows in spaces like that all the time. And as a person who went to art school, I've been into gallery spaces like that all the time. And there's something that's really touching me deep about it. So I went and listened to, like, several different songs because there's a lot of musicians that died in the fire.
Yeah.
And this particular group, Intro Flirt, had two people, one named Benjamin Runnels, who has been found and declared dead in the fire, and then another one, Nicole Donaldo Renee, who's still missing. So it's really sad that they're gone, and in a way that, like, this was the way I found their music. But I still wanted to play it because I thought it was great. It has this, like, sexy sheen to it. Apparently they called their music Croon Wave, which I just like as a name. And, yeah, I hope we can just start playing it around.
And the misnomer of rave also to what was happening in that space.
Yeah. Right.
With so many, it's kind of like electro pop or this kind of particular music. I mean, at this point, I know two parties who've lost children in that fire who are musicians and who are young and who are trans kids.
Yeah.
And it's, and they, you know, it's really devastating.
Yeah, there's been a few trans kids that were lost in that fire.
And also just the idea that it was some like kind of out of control rave party, you know, like, or like the descriptor rave really fails to account for what the kind of artistic community was and the queer community was who was gathering there.
Right. I think that kind of artist space, you know, we all know it. It's so valuable. And to mislabel it that way is really
It's been like a rough year for queer people. Our spaces that were safe have had these tragedies befall them. And the night that Orlando happened, I was at a warehouse party. I remember telling friends, it's interesting like how like this feels like such a safe space of queer people dancing. It's our music. It's just us. It's private. Yeah. And then the worst news in the world happened. And to think that even in that space, danger can befall you in all sorts of ways is so deeply tragic.
I want to say, too, because I forgot to say the title of the song, Playing Elevator.
Karen, you got a gem?
I mean, like, okay, to produce a jam after that conversation.
I know, I'm sorry to bring in heavy,
No, I mean, you know, it's actually funny because, like, again, like with most things, with consuming pop culture this whole time, again, like to talk post-November 8th or whatever, has been really difficult. And I've talked about, like, how I can't hear Fight Song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, or You Can Call Me Al, or Roar without, like, falling apart in my automobile. But
I heard Roar on an airplane, and I cried so hard.
It's, like, really, and I'm just like, I can't believe, you know. I was at a karaoke bar, and they played Don't Stop Thinking Tomorrow, Thinking About Tomorrow, in between, you know, like, songs that people were singing, and I just like really started crying. I mean, it's like tragical, as the Backstreet Boys would say. In any case, also to tie it back to, I almost selected a song from Camelot given our theme, and I, you know, it was going to be What Do the Simple Folk Do? And then I was like, oh, I'm thinking about a post-apocalyptic songs from the 80s. But on my way over here, I heard this song that really spoke to me, just like on probably Kiss FM or like, you know, local pop radio. I don't know much about it. It's by John Bellion, who apparently is like known as a kind of mixtape artist who just released a debut album this last year. And it's called All Time Low. And I'll just let it play.
Was the prototype like three stacks on that CD?
I mean, you know, one of the reasons it compelled me is that, you know, in many respects to me, it sounds like, you know, the winning band from like whatever that a cappella like reality series was, The Sing Off or something like that hosted by Nick Lachey. But also like because John Bellion himself said, you know, this song was actually composed a couple of years ago and he thought of it as a kind of in the spirit of like Owl City or whatever, which is embarrassing to be like, oh, I like a song in the spirit of Owl City. But, you know, it's very much a song that is about a breakup, but the song is All Time Low, and it's so much about, like, kind of really grappling with these really, you know, whatever, kind of scrapey bottom emotions, but, like, it has a kind of buoyancy to the way it's, you know, you can kind of hear it in that, like that little bit of the chorus that you heard. So, anyway, it struck me on the radio tonight, hot off the jam sessions.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, Karen. You guys have been listening to Pop Rocket. It's hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler and our special guest, Karen Thompson, and Chris Schleicher. Chris, you got anything to promote?
I'm going to promote my Twitter account, C Schleich's Run, or you can search Chris Schleicher, S-C-H-L-E-I-C-H-E-R. I'm the most popular one. You can catch my episodes of The Mindy Project on Hulu.
Oh, are you a writer or performer on The Mindy Project?
It's interesting. I'm a little bit of both. I once played Chip the medical receptionist, but in this upcoming second half of the season, I'll be playing Nurse Chris in a scene along with a nurse called Nurse Guy.
Oh, really? I can't wait to see that. Ooh. Margaret Wappler, you still got that novel out there?
I do. It's called Neon Green, and it's available at the finest of bookstores.
It's really, really good. You guys should get it.
On best of 2016 lists.
That's right.
Oh, did you make some lists?
I made a couple lists.
Tell us what lists you made, Margaret.
Entropy is one list, and actually, that's it.
Well, that's exciting.
First one.
Yeah.
And Karen Toxin, you got anything to promote?
Well, you'll find me at Inland Emperor, like, railing against the new regime. But also, very recently, I was a guest on the Blaze 90210 podcast.
Ooh.
Where I talked about the episode It's Greek to Me, when all the folks from, you know, Beverly Hills High are at California University.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, you know, like, hand-wringing about whether or not to join a sorority, hints of anti-Semitism against Andrea.
Poor Andrea.
And, you know, basically very prescient discussions about political correctness. And in any case, if you missed me on Pop Rocket, you can hear me talking about a bunch of other stuff there.
We need to campaign to get you on Gilmore Guys. Like, just for, like, a mailbag episode or something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Kiki420, MD Hiker, Jessica H711, Rose of New York, Flipflops122, KMH410 for these 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Clearly, Karen being out of the studio last week for a vaguely medical reason made people worried about her health, Chris, as you understand.
You mean Margaret?
You mean me? Margaret?
Yes. What did I say?
You said Karen.
You said Karen. But
you guys all look alike to me. it's a well-known fact that if we do not get enough positive reviews, Margaret will die by some reasons, whether it's nature or my hand. No one knows.
Right. You'll just breathe strep throat directly on me.
But thanks for all of those 5-star reviews. If you've got an opinion you want to share about this week's topics, you can join in the conversation on our Facebook group or tweet at us. We are at Pop Rocket. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the very informative Kara Hart and the charming Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.